Okay. So, in this talk, I'm going to talk about an alternative way to build anonymization systems. So this has been used in computer science and computer security, but it's something I've seen used much less frequently in the fields that deal with building statistics, and in particular, things that look a bit like sensors. So it's quite common to talk about an anonymization system as just one homogeneous entity, but there's a few characteristics that I'm going to be talking about, so I thought it would be helpful to start off with what I actually mean by these terms. So the first one is the architecture of the system. So this is how it's built, who participates in it, how is the data collected, stored, processed, and distributed. But separate from the architecture is the security definition that this system must actually perform. And a typical example of this is differential privacy, although, of course, we've heard about many others, both at this event and others. And then finally, there's the mechanism of how do you actually achieve these security definitions within the overall architecture. And what I'm going to be talking about is about experimenting with a different architecture for building these systems. And in particular, what I'm going to look at is ways where you no longer have to have a central organization which is trusted to maintain the security definition, but you still do not require people submitting the data to ensure that they protect their own plausible deniability. So I'll explain what I mean throughout the rest of the presentation. So the typical way that people build and people think about anonymization is to have a trusted centralized architecture. So there's someone at the beginning, and someone at the middle, and classical example is the Census Bureau. And what the Census Bureau does is it takes sensitive data from data subjects. So this could be a census form, it could be medical records, it could be location records. And the other thing that they receive is requests from analysts. So these sorts of requests could be very detailed SQL queries, or they could just be a request to the Census Bureau that we like analysis that is of this particular form. And then what comes out of it is anonymous data. So I'm not being very precise in when I say anonymous, but by anonymous I mean that it's considered acceptable for this data to be publicly known. So this is called a trusted architecture. And I mean something very specific by trust. Trust is one of these very confusing words which means different things in different fields, and it's almost its own opposite. But I'm using trusted in the term of computer security, and a trusted organization is one that can violate your security. So it's not the warm, fuzzy feeling that you're there when you're with a friend who you know will not do anything bad to you. Trust is an actively bad thing that must be minimized. So in the architecture, the area that has been highlighted in the rectangle is the parts of the system that are trusted. These are the parts of the system that if they go wrong, you will have serious problems. So the user submitting their data, obviously they have access to the raw data, it's sensitive. If their computer starts leaking this data, they've got a problem. The central organization, say Census Bureau, is in a very sensitive situation because if they leak the data or they don't perform the anonymization properly, there's a problem. And also the analysts, in some circumstances, will have to be trusted. That's why people who are accessing sensitive data have to go on training courses. They have to go through vetting. They have to use specific tools in order to ensure that they protect their security. And the reason for all of these parts being trusted is because the data that is being submitted is inherently sensitive. Even if you de-identify this data, it would still be a problem. And in order to still give data subjects confidence, what you have to do is ensure that all of these parts of the system are performing anonymization properly. And that's expensive. So it's expensive in two ways. So one is that you have to have an organization that has the staff and security procedures that are adequate to protect the security, and that all costs money. But then the second part is opportunity cost. There are certain legitimate things that people will not allow to happen because the architecture doesn't support it. So, for example, it's common in secure data environments that you're not allowed to use things like Google Docs and Dropbox. You're not allowed to use email. And this gets in the way. It causes the staff who are subject to these restrictions to be upset. It causes them to be less effective at doing their job, even though these other technologies that they're not allowed to use might actually be helpful. So the other place that trust comes in is in security specifications. And this is the Rainbow series of books. And the one up here is the Orange Book. And this is the origin of the common criteria specifications that some of you might have seen if you're building secure data environments. And the title of this book is Department of Defense Trusted Computer Systems Evaluation Criteria. Here, again, trusted means that it's something that can violate your security. It should be minimized and protected rather than something that you try to ensure is something you get a lot more of. So in this architecture, you have all of these three parties who are trusted. And this is a centralized architecture, but there's actually other ways that you can build centralized architectures within this model. And the way that they differ is in their security definition and also whether it's interactive or non-interactive. So interactive is where someone submits queries to the organization and they get responses back. And then non-interactive is where an anonymized data set comes out at the end. In terms of security definitions, there's many of these, but one example is differential privacy, another one is key anonymity, and almost any of these combinations are possible. So in the classic way that people describe differential privacy, they think of it in the interactive case, where some noise is added to the responsive queries. But differential privacy also works perfectly well in aggregate statistics. Similarly, in key anonymity, that can be applied in both the interactive and non-interactive sense. So the point behind this slide is to show that although architecture and the security definition are linked with the mechanism, they're not actually the same, and this leads to confusion. So I think one example of this confusion is a quote from a very good paper by Philip Rogoway, The Moral Character of Cryptographic Work. And he criticizes differential privacy because it has authoritarian conceptual underpinnings. But I think this is not the right characterization. Really, what the characterization is about is the interactive centralized architecture. And the reason that this is problematic is because it gives power to these central authorities. They are the ones who have access to the very sensitive data because the anonymity is only added in response to the queries rather than added to the data as it's stored. And secondly, it means that these organizations naturally act as gatekeepers. And even if they are acting entirely properly, they still are able to exert control because of the power that is given to them by the data. So I think this quote would be perfectly correct and very valid if it was about centralized interactive architectures, but not so much when it's applied just to differential privacy. So there is a problem here. And the problem is going to get worse. And one of the reasons that the problem is getting worse is because confidence in institutions is at an all-time historical low. So this is a Pew survey, which is looking at the percentage of people who believe that trust in the government in Washington always or most of the time. And the general trend is it's going down.
And
yes. And this is not just restricted to the US government. If you ask people about their trust in institutions, it's going down. It's at one of the lowest levels possible. And now if you tell them that the way that you get anonymity is by giving all your data to a central institution, then people will be upset. They might not give data, they might mm-hmm. give the wrong data. And I think one example of where this is now being tested is that there's calls to shut down the US Census because the president-elect has suggested building a Muslim registry. Now, the US Census doesn't actually collect records that are directly specific to do with religion, but there's something that you can probably infer from name. And certainly other organizations do collect religious information. And because these are stored in central organizations, then people will perhaps consider this not acceptable. So what is the alternative to centralized architectures? Well, one is, rather than submitting sensitive data to the central authority, you submit anonymized data to the central authority. So this is called the local anonymization model. It can be applied to differential privacy, it can apply to the other approaches, but the key part is that what the central authority get is no longer considered sensitive. Now, one example of this is Google Rapport. So in terms of architecture, it's an untrusted central authority because the central authority does not see sensitive data. And in this case, it preserves differential privacy, and the way it does so is randomized response. So randomized response is not a new technique. It can be done using pen and paper, it has been done using pen and paper, and it was designed to help people get statistics on the answer to sensitive questions. So for example, are you a member of the Communist Party? Now here, saying yes is quite problematic. Saying no is safe. So the way that you run randomized response is that the person who is submitting the data tosses a fair coin. If it's heads, they say yes, and if it's no, tell the truth. So in this case, the people who are submitting data have plausible deniability, because if they said yes, then actually probably they're not a communist, so that's okay. But when you add up all this data, then you can start extracting a count of the expected number of communists, and also you can work out what the error is on this particular value. So what the Rapport does is takes this approach and it extends it to arbitrary values, and then they show that, subject to certain caveats, this fills the criteria of differential privacy. And this means that even though when Google use this, which they do in Chrome, when you send your data to Google, even though that data is linked to your IP address, it's linked to the cookies that Google know about you, and Google know a lot about you, it's considered safe because the sensitive data has noise added to it at the point it's submitted. So if anyone's got any questions, then please feel free to ask. So Rapport is quite nice, but the situations where it can be used are quite limited. So this is a synthetic example from the Rapport paper, and what they were trying to do was estimate the distribution of a data set which so happened to be have a normal distribution. And they looked at 10,000 samples, 100,000 samples, and 1 million samples. And you can see that even with 10,000 samples, what you get is actually not particularly good. With 100,000 samples, you start to get close, and it's really only when you get to 1 million samples that you get to see the proper probability distribution. Another example of where Google actually use it is by tracking people's home pages. And what they found is that you can only get knowledge that a particular home page exists if 14,000 users all set it to your home page. So in one sense, this is good. This means that obscure home pages, the ones that are probably more sensitive, are completely invisible to Google. But it's also bad, because unless you're a company with the power of Google, where you have so many users, then you will not actually be able to gain any insight from a system like Rapport, at least as it's been built. There's also some caveats in terms of where you can deploy it. In particular, it assumes that there's no unknown correlation between consecutive responses to queries, because if you give the same response twice, the Rapport deals with that. But if there is correlation that you don't take into account, then you will gradually leak more and more information, and then you will no longer get the same security properties that you want. So you cannot just plug in rapport to any situation, and then a magical answer will pop out. So can you just do something a bit different? What happens if, rather than having just local anonymization here, going to the central authority along with identifiers, what happens if you extend the security not only to the anonymization, but also to the way that the data is being sent? Now you can do something a bit better. If the data is not sensitive just in itself, but if de-identification is adequate for security, then you no longer have to trust the central authority. So, for example, one place that this would not work is medical records. We know very well if you just take the name off medical records, the thing that you get out there is not anonymous. It can be very easily linked up to people's identity. But if it's something like age, for example, the fact that person with IP address 42 is of age 35 is sensitive, whereas the fact that there is at least one person somewhere in the world that's of age 35 is not sensitive. So in that sort of case, the identification is probably going to be sufficient. Some other examples. So this figure is from an analysis by Newstar of the New York Taxi dataset. So this was an example of how not to do anonymization. And what they were able to plot is the start destinations for taxi rides which ended at a strip club. That's obviously very sensitive data, but there's also quite legitimate reasons why you might want to have information about people's travel through a city. It's useful for planning out traffic light systems. It's useful for adding extra resources. So what happens if, rather than giving the entire route, you split the route into segments, and then you ensure that each segment of that route cannot be linked to another segment of the route, and you ensure that they cannot be linked up to where they ultimately came from. In that case, provided the data is submitted securely and the IP address of the person submitting it is not something that the central authority gets, then you do have something that is maybe adequately secure. The unlinkability property is actually twofold. The first thing is that you have to unlink the data submission from the identity of the person submitting them, and secondly, you have to unlink the data submission from any other data submission. So as long as you get both of those properties, then you can still have the identified data being submitted. Another example, this one is a real example. So this was a consortium of large defense contractors. They were very worried about being hacked, and they wanted to share data about the attacks that they were seeing in order that they could then prevent it. However, these companies really dislike each other. They don't trust each other, and they don't really trust any central authority either. So what they wanted to do was share this data in an anonymous way, such that they knew that attacks were happening, but they didn't know which organization was actually contributing this attack data. Now, they've got to anonymize the data itself. They've got to make sure that the company name and so on doesn't actually appear in that data set. But there's techniques for doing that. And then they submit it to a central authority, but rather than directly, they send it via some intermediaries in order to unlink one submission with another submission and unlink the submission with their identity. And they were able to do this without having to use approaches like rapport, which didn't exist at the time, and also probably would not be suitable for submitting such rich data and data with unknown structure. So how do you actually do this? Well, there's real systems which do this unlinkability. Most common one is called Tor. And the way that Tor works is that users install software on their computer, and the software presents itself as a web browser, but actually within that web browser is the real Tor, and Tor is actually not linked to web browsing in any way. It can be used with custom protocols, and in fact it was always intended to be used with custom protocols. So what the Tor software on that user's computer is, it chooses some intermediaries to send the data through to hide the traces that the data has and hide where it came from. Now, question is, where do these people come from? And also, how do you arrange a network like this without introducing a central authority, which was what we were trying to avoid in the first place? The way that you do this is that the network is built up of computers that are run by volunteers, and also the list of computers is built up using a consensus algorithm, similar to what's now had a lot of interest in what's used by Bitcoin. And what this means is that there's no one individual who's able to modify the map of the network in a way that would allow that person to tamper with people's communications. So what the Tor system does is it chooses three computers at random from the network. So let's suppose it chooses this one, and this one. And then it makes an encrypted path through the network. Every hop on this path is encrypted. And so the first person there, who is on the path, this one, knows where the communications are coming from. So in this case, Alice. The last one knows where the communications are going, in this case, Bob, or the central authority. But provided these two computers are not colluding, there's no one person who can link the source to the destination. And each time a new item of data comes in, the path is discarded, a new one is created, and that gives the unlinkability between different data submissions. Going into a little bit more detail, there is encryption used at two parts. So the first one is hop by hop. There are three nodes in the connection. There's the entry node, the middle node, and the exit node. And then there is encryption here between the user and entry node, here between the entry and the middle node, and here between the entry and exit node. But then the other thing that's going on is there's encryption end-to-end. And these are shown in the colors. So there is encryption between the user and the first node here. Then there's encryption between the user and the middle node here. And then there's encryption that goes all the way to the exit node, the final node in the connection. And what these two types of encryption do is they make sure that the data that is coming into any one hop, so for example, you've got this data coming in here, looks completely different to the data that is coming out. So you cannot use the data content in order to link someone's traffic coming in with traffic that is coming out. And that's in order to preserve the unlinkability. But Tor is not perfect, nor is any other commonly used anonymity system. And the major weakness is they hide traffic content, they do not hide traffic patterns. So if you start to look up something like the amount of data sent over time here, coming into the network, and the data that comes out, these will look almost exactly the same. And one of the topics of my research is how do you try to hide the correlation, not just based on content, but based on traffic patterns. But this is still quite a hard problem. However, for many purposes, it is sufficient to just hide traffic pattern or hide content. And although it is possible to de-anonymize people based on the traffic patterns, that is a much harder thing to do. Possible for intelligence agencies, but if you're not worried about intelligence agencies as part of your security definition, then that might be okay. So in this talk, I've tried to show that there's an alternative to the two extremes of having a centralized model where you have to trust almost everybody in the system and having a local anonymization model where there's no trust in the central authority, but you do have to make quite significant changes to the data and know quite a lot about the data before you can use it. The reason this is relevant is that the fully centralized model, while popular, has risk of being compromised if the central authority gets hacked, and it's also expensive to set up, both in terms of monetary cost and opportunity cost. And I think the problems that people are having with institutions are only going to get worse in the short to medium term, and that trust will affect the feasibility of having central authorities being used and relied upon for anonymization. In terms of the other extreme of local anonymization, while powerful and works well in the cases it's used, it isn't applicable in all situations, and it still actually has some of the authoritarian tendencies that it was intended to address, because only the most large and powerful organizations will be able to deploy a technique like that and get statistical significance in the results that come out of it. So if it's possible to arrange your data so that de-identification is enough, so the data itself is not sensitive, its sensitivity is only when it's linked to an identity or linked to other submissions of data, then using a system which anonymizes the communications is an option that I think you should definitely look into. And I'm very happy to talk more about this in detail and in questions now.
We were thinking along the same vein, and we presented, I think, in July, this idea of collaborative anonymization. Mm-hmm. Because if you do things, and there we first, there was a first stage of anonymization of, in the case of K-anonymity, quasi identifiers, and then there was a second stage in which the confidential information was sent using Tor.
Yeah.
But if you don't do anything to the information before sending it using Tor, then there is no guarantee that you cannot re-identify anyone. Because that, as you say, the content itself can be re-identifying. Mm. So it's not just a matter of sending confidential information anonymously, but you must make sure that it is not, it cannot be used to re-identify the sender.
Yes.
The information itself, not the metadata.
Yeah. Yes. You're definitely right.
I would encourage you to use something like this collaborative idea.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Any other questions? So how do you see this in the future, to combine with the functional privacy and other? Because I mean, why are you doing something fairly different?
Yeah.
Statistical agency is going to take on this technique.
So, and again, differential privacy is a security definition rather than a mechanism. So I don't see any reason why differential privacy could not be one of the security properties that you get out of this, subject to certain caveats about assumptions on Tor. What I'm not sure is how that could concretely be, could actually be built, but I've got no reason to think it's impossible. Yeah?
Can you comment a little bit on the concept of Byzantine fault tolerance in this type of a setting? Or just fault tolerance in general, because I mean I think it's an intriguing concept about, you know, decentralizing some of the computation or at least splitting the computation where things get separate sent at separate times. Mm. And so like this question of collusion comes up just all over the place. And so like I know part of it's been solved in the context of Tor, or at least, you know, mixed nets in general. Mm-hmm. So if you could address this, it'd be helpful.
Yeah, it is a very challenging problem to solve. So the security property that is dependent upon is that two people who are claiming to be distinct entities will not collude. And then the question of how do you actually how do you understand whether these two people are really different people, or whether they are the same person giving two names, called a Sybil attack. Or whether they're going to collude anyway. And different systems achieve this in different ways. So there's the Anon system, which was set up in Dresden by Andreas Fitzman. And the way that they tried to practically assure this is, in order to join the network, you had to show up with government ID and sign a contract to say you would not collude. So that comes out of the sort of German system, where government ID is a thing and its contracts are considered to be trusted.
That would require you to register your computer as well, so your IP address would be like fixed at that point?
This is in order to contribute to the network rather than use the network, because the people contributing to the network are the one who are in a position to harm security. To use a system, you didn't have to do anything. Whereas Tor came from the more American anarchist approach, where government ID doesn't even exist and signing a contract doesn't seem to mean anything. And what they do instead is that they look at the people who are contributing to the network and try to look for suspicious patterns. And they catch some people sometimes, they don't catch people all the times. There's probably a bit that can be said for both of them. So in fact, the largest proportion of Tor bandwidth is actually contributed by quite public organizations. It's not just people in their dorm rooms, because it's far cheaper to have a lot of bandwidth in one computer than to share that over 10,000 computers. And so it's actually very clear who is running most of the Tor nodes, or at least most of the bandwidth in the Tor nodes. In terms of the Byzantine fault tolerance, there's bits and pieces of that used in Tor. So for example, the consensus algorithm does have Byzantine fault tolerance, in the sense that it will never result in a bad situation coming out. However, it does not guarantee to terminate. So if there is enough bad people in the network, actually just even one person who's bad in these eight directory authorities, they will be able to cause the process not to terminate. And then the ways for dealing with that would have to be outside. There are newer anonymity systems that exist on paper rather than in reality that have got better security. However, they're harder to build, and so they don't actually exist.
Everybody. Let's thank all the speakers of this morning's sessions, and we'll reconvene.